Hey, everybody. I'm Danny Schechter. I'm your news dissector. I'm here 5 o'clock on Thursdays here on the Progressive Radio Network.com, PRN.FM. And as usual, when you do a program with somebody from another country, that person mistakes the west side of Manhattan with the east side of Manhattan. So she's on the east side. I'm on the west side. We're going to try to get her on the telephone right now and interview her on the phone and have her join us. And I'll tell you more about who she is once we get through to her. But I'm back, as you know, from a summer in South Africa. And I brought some music with me to share with you. We're going to open the program with another kind of song poem by Mzwaki Mbuli, who's known as the People's Poet. Kat Waters is with me. You've just come from the Mets game, right?
I haven't been to a ball game in a while. It was very interesting.
And at Citi Field, do you feel any conflict going to a field named after a bank?
Well, the tickets were actually free.
Oh, in that case.
They gave out 7,000 tickets for free just to fill the stadium.
There you go. Well, that says
because
something.
Because it was the Mets' last home game.
I guess that says something about the amount of money people have to spend, and recreation. But I'd like to hear more about the game in a minute. But first, let's hear Mzwaki Mbuli and get this program on the move here on News Dissector Radio.
Amalgamation than acrimony. People choose Albertina Sisul and Agostino Neto. People choose bonding than bondage. Choose brilliance than bickering. People choose Beasumodi and Bram Fischer. People choose communication than confrontation. Choose credentials than crime. Choose Christiani and Che Guevara. People choose dancing than drugs. People choose democracy than dictatorship. Choose Dorothy Nyembe and Didani Kimathi.
All right, so this is from an album called Amanla, means power. Struggle song, songs of freedom, Mzwaki Mbuli. I picked this up in South Africa. I'm going to play a little bit more for you as we move on. The first tune that we just heard is called The Choice Is Yours, and we'll hear a little bit more from him. But I was hoping to have in the studio with me a terrific African journalist who's in town covering the UN General Assembly, someone I admire greatly, who's the editor of Africa International Magazine, Marie-Roger Biloa. Are you with me, Marie?
Yes, I'm there, Danny. I wish I would be.
Okay, I explained the problem of people from other parts of the world mistaking the east side from the west side. But that's okay. You should know better, though, because you've lived in New York, or you've been in New York a lot. Have you been over at the UN at all? What's your sense of the General Assembly? What's your sense of how
I've been there. And yeah. This year around is a very special year. I would say there are too many, like the Francophone head of state missing, and we were surprised not to have the main actor on the Mali crisis. Like the president of Mali is not there, the president of Burkina Faso, the president of Cote d'Ivoire, the president of Guinea, all of them are missing, and even the president of Niger. You know, they came to Paris. They were on their way to the summit, and guess what happened? The chief of protocol in the plane got a collapse, and he died.
Oh.
So they landed in Paris and then back to Niamey. So that is, for us covering all these countries is
shame that many of these leaders can't get here, but as you know, and we're competing with the sounds of the street in New York, everybody, so I'm sorry about that because I just got the call that, she wouldn't be able to join us. But as you know, in the United States, the big issue is Iran. That's what all the hype has been about. And now today, yes. Bibi Netanyahu spoke and wagged his finger and talked about the need for red lines and warned of, you know, an impending nuclear bomb in the hands of Iran and all the rest of this. And that's been basically the discourse. And left out of the discourse have been people from all over the world who are dealing with every day poverty, development, disease, all kinds of problems that the UN was established to try to help. And there are a lot of African delegates who are very frustrated by the way in which those issues have been pushed off to the side. How do you feel about that?
Yeah, you're right. But, you know, African countries are not depending so much on, let's say, the pledge to help. You know, that's been the topic for decades. And now they are really stressing the need to do business, to invest. You know, they want Americans, they want Europeans to come and invest. And, you know, just speaking about the areas where you need some kind of humanitarian aid, it's not really a priority now. And
just on this whole point, let me just ask you about a question, I think, involving your own country, Cameroon,
yes.
Where, you know, outsiders have come and bought up large tracts of land, controlling the food supply in many cases in parts of the country, and they're doing it for export, while people in the various African countries are not eating, you know, adequately. Is this concerning to you? Do you feel there's a danger here?
Yes, it's concerning, very much so. You know, there's a big problem African countries are dealing with, is that land grabbing, where you have now such a rush, a land rush, so to say, where countries sell huge portions of land to corporations, to foreign corporations, in very opaque contracts, where you don't know exactly for how long, what are they supposed to do with the land, and what is the money involved, and the figures are horrendous, because they say it's like half of the land which has been sold like a year like 2009 or 2010. Half of the land in the whole world was sold in Africa and to foreign corporations.
Foreigners say, well, this is good for your country because it promotes development, it helps promote your agricultural systems, blah, blah, blah. But
yeah,
it seems like there's a loss of sovereignty.
You know what? What those corporations do basically is to grow all kinds of crops for their own markets, for their own countries. So you don't have much food left for the local places where they are. This is just a big problem. And also, some of the villages have been expelled from their land, you know, because the government has decided to sell.
Things like
hold,
this.
Hold on, let me introduce you. Marie Roger, I have with me Catherine Waters, who's kind of co-hosting the show, has a question for you.
No, I mean, I just wanted to make a comment. I mean, the corporations have been doing things like this for, you know, decades. I mean, you know, they move in, the rich corporations, and they present it like, oh, yeah, you know, the little guy is going to benefit. And then they never do. Only like a few rich always benefit. I mean, so, you know, it's almost kind of safe to say at this point that, you know, it's pretty definite they're not really looking out to benefit the small guy.
Yes. That definitely. And, you know, sometimes it takes time for people to realize what is really going on. The problem with the land of the corporation was maybe apparent and clear for a minority of people. But now it has become a general topic. Everybody speaking about it, but maybe also because the phenomenon has grown and it has even the little man in the street sees that there is a problem with that, because the government used to promise huge benefits out of that, and they didn't see anything. And now it's been a topic, and it's been a concern, an official one, where you have civil society building groups and trying to reverse some of the contracts. And you know that a president was overthrown over such a deal, a land deal with a South Korean corporation that was in Madagascar. So, and I think this case brought exposure to the problem. But actually, the main the concern now in relationship with other countries is that the Africans, many African countries, are not they don't have the capacity to really negotiate with I would say foreign investors. They to say, well, okay, the rule has changed. We are not in a colonial context anymore. If you want to deal with us, we are partners, and we are the one to set the rules. So, and they are not just not really doing that. Maybe some countries a little bit like
if I come to you and I want to do a land grab in your country, and I say, okay, you'll be my junior partner. I'm going to advance, you know, $50,000 to you.
Yes.
And you don't have any money. That sounds like a very attractive offer. And often you find, you know, that the local politicians are on the take more than they're trying to really help their country.
Right.
Yes, definitely. That's the way it happens. It's never official. You hear about it behind the scene. Somebody is whispering, it seems that. And then when you go after that, they don't, we as journalists, you never get straight information about that. If you have to research on your own and you have contact detail, and they are lying to you, the officials are lying to you, and the contractors are lying, everybody trying to hide that. So it's they don't publish it in the press, and you always have one official or two official or three officials, a little group of people selling land in very obscure conditions. Nobody knows exactly why. And that situation
sounds like the mortgage scandal.
Most of the time it's not even official.
She says that it sounds a little like the mortgage scandal in America. But there is another development in Africa that you know, everyone is sort of thinking about. I don't know what the impact is, but the presence of China seems to have changed the equation quite a bit. China seems to have a lot more money than the West because of the financial crisis, and the Chinese seem to be investing more in Africa and working more with Africans. When I was with you in Gabon at a media conference, there was a journalist there from Paris, but from a Chinese network. Now there are Chinese journalists and Chinese business people all over the continent. Is this a positive thing in your view, or is it a new form of colonialism?
This is not a simple issue. I would say our first reaction was really enthusiastic, because when the Chinese started showing interest to Africa, this is not new. The Chinese have always been there, you know, building stadiums, this kind of thing, sports equipment, whatever. They've been there. But 10 years ago, they had a new impulse, sort of upsurge, where they came back again, where they decided to increase their presence in Africa. And I must say, it was at a time when Africa was presented as a lost continent. You remember the cover story, I think it was Time or Newsweek, I don't know, the last continent of the hopeless continent, Africa, the hopeless continent. And I also remember when, as a journalist in Paris, I was seeing delegations, African delegations coming to Paris to try to attract investors. And the Europeans were like, with their checking list, do you have this and that? You don't. This? No, you don't. This and that? You don't. So we don't come there. It was like, you don't have infrastructure, so we don't come here. You don't have electricity. You don't have water. And it was like, that's why we need you. We need you to come and invest. so that we have the roads, we have the infrastructure, we have whatever it takes to be developed. But and they were not interested in Africa, and they were, and the I would say the rhetoric was very negative about Africa. And
well, you know, I was just
and now when the Chinese came without any posing conditions and. Started saying, "Oh, you don't get money from the World Bank. Okay, we can handle that."
Yeah, I mean, one of the interesting things when I was in South Africa this summer, I noticed I was living right next door to the China Construction Bank and another big building, you know, of Chinese industry. And it seemed like the Chinese loans to African projects were longer term loans and lower interest loans, that they were really kind of cooperating with the African business and government communities in a way that we didn't see from the Western, you know, groups that are much more short-term, you know, get in, get rich, get out kind of people. And it seemed like they were there for with a longer-term perspective. They've just allocated something like $20 billion for loans in Africa. It seems like a major development.
It's the opposite of a loan, though. I mean, the whole purpose of a loan is to help the borrower, you know, not to really, I mean, you know, it's got to be beneficial for both parties and at least the person that's doing the borrowing. And so if it's like the Western people that are just, you know, in and out, like trying to make a quick buck, I mean, it kind of defeats the whole purpose of a loan in the first place.
Absolutely. And you know what? Since the Chinese came back or showed an increased interest, now the European, the Americans are changing. Oh, they're looking at Africa, having a second glance at Africa and find it very sexy, very interesting. And so we were glad about that, you know, because it was like, Africa, you are hopeless. So if we want us to do something, the checklist was very long. And it was like, you don't get money from us until you are real democracies, which is not so easy to achieve. You know, democracy has been, even in Europe, in America, democracy is still not perfect. And, you know, African countries have like only 50 years experience in that. So they came and they want things to happen exactly the way they are in Europe or in America. So Chinese don't come with that. You say, okay, you are the way you are. What do we need for them?
You know one of the things with the loans that were made by Western aid agencies like the United States.
Yes.
The stipulation is that you have to spend the money in the United States. You have to buy goods. It's a stimulus program for Americans more than for Africans. And so.
Definitely.
So, you know.
And there is a paradigm shift with the Chinese. But we have to be honest. We have to see that. And you get money easily. And I remember, let me quote President Wade. President Wade, Senegal former president, he used to say, you know, with the European Union, when you sit down and say, well, we would like to build a road between Dakar and Jobel or whatever. So between the moment you decide to do that and the time you set the pose the first stone or you start work, that he said 3 years. With the Chinese, 3 months. So you see, things are changing. And also, like you say, these stipulations, the Chinese, a minister from Rwanda was saying, you know, the difference between the Chinese and the other partners is that.
Marie-Roger, can I just cut you off for 1 second? Because there may be a caller that might want to come in and ask a question. Catherine, could you give the number?
Yeah, if anybody wants to call and join the conversation, the number is toll-free 888-874-4888. If you have any questions or comments, if anybody wants to enlighten us with their knowledge about the subject, 888-874-4888.
Okay, I mean, you know, the other issue right now is the American presence in Africa, which seems to be increasingly a militarized and military presence, you know, with the African command, the involvement in Mali, the involvement in Somalia, military, you know, interventionism. And, you know, a lot of people are very concerned about the implications of all of that, that it's not necessarily what Africa needs, more foreign intervention.
Yeah. You know, what happened is that after 9/11, the American government set priority on war on terror. And that was, I mean, determining the whole foreign policy. And also in Africa, that they just look at the danger zones where you have this infiltration of possible terrorists, this Al-Qaeda people, and whatever. And so the government, the American government have been investing a lot of money in that, forgetting that, you know, instability is also caused by poverty, by, you know, lack of joblessness and all kind of things, and unstable social conditions, and that really to eradicate or really curb this danger, terrorism danger, the real thing is to help the countries develop, you know, and the terrorists will have less ground and will be not be able to recruit the way they do now. The youth have nothing to do.
Let me give you a little example of something mm-hmm. I observed when I was in South Africa. Mm-hmm. You know, the United States has been part of this whole sanctions regime against Iran. Iran mm-hmm. supplied 42% of South Africa's crude oil.
Yeah.
For historical reasons, Iran was helping South Africa when it made the transition to a democracy, and they mm-hmm. sold oil less expensively to South Africa because, you know, Iran revolution, South African revolution, etc. Now the United States, because of its hostility to Iran, pressured the South African government to cut off all Iranian crude oil. Period.
Mm-hmm.
Finished. Yeah. And instead, you know, Iran is a dictatorship in their view, but the oil is now coming from Saudi Arabia, which is hardly mm-hmm. a democracy, okay?
Yeah,
and,
absolutely.
And no sooner did this happen than they announced an increase in the price of petrol at the pump, you know, almost a full rand a gallon, which is going to hurt you know, the poorest people, you know, because it's going to lead to an inflationary cycle. So our foreign policy interests basically are imposed on a country. And South Africa was told either you do this or you can't sell your goods in America. So it was like the carrot and the stick. You know, they didn't want to do it, but they were forced to do it. And mm-hmm. the consequence is that the consumers in South Africa, the poorest people, are paying for it. It's crazy.
That's not the first time you have that double standard, actually, that you do pressure on people dealing with Iran and not with people dealing with Saudi Arabia or even, I mean, America itself dealing with Saudi Arabia. So it's a double standard. But you have that also for democracy. You have countries which are supposed to be friends of America, like Uganda or Rwanda. Those people, the head of state, they have been in power for decades, and you don't hear any pressure for them to accept a multi-party party politics or election, or you have rigged elections, and you know, you have things like that. But
in terms of all of this, though, it seems like one of the important antidotes to these problems, you know, of a lack of democracy, we need more democracy, and we need a strong media presence in Africa.
Mm-hmm.
And you've been out there, out front for years, trying to promote a journalism that really speaks to the needs of African people. Can you just tell us a little bit, because we only have a few minutes left, can you tell us a little bit about your magazine, Africa International? It's in French, based in Paris, but also French Africa. Tell us about what you've been covering and what the response has been.
This is African International. Is a historic magazine. It has accompanied the countries during the struggle for independence. So it turned 50 in 2008, and it is an independent magazine which I took over in 1990. So, and then we created other magazines which are well less focusing on the people. You know, we need to create role models for the youth, to show them successful Africans, you know, not only in terms of making money, but people with a heart, with people, you know, showing solidarity or choosing a kind of jobs which are very useful for the community, and that they are very, very successful. They call it People Magazine, but not in the way you know them in America, not so on glamour, I don't know what, but they are serious.
Right, so the reason for that, I think maybe our listeners don't realize that, you know, so much of the media is about the elite. It's about the political elite. It's about the economic elite, because those are the people.
Like Africa International, actually. That's why we felt the need to do something else, you know, connecting directly to the little man, if you want, to everybody, to the students, to the market women, whenever she can read. You know, so you have them in the magazine. We had simple people, you know, who you can show as example, because they are achievers in what they do, and they are, I mean, powerful figures, models for society.
Well, you know, in my mind and in my view, you know, you are one of the leading journalists in Africa. You're a woman on the cutting edge of all of these issues. You're not that well known, perhaps, because your language is French primarily.
Yes.
But, you know, everybody who in African journalism knows about you, knows your long commitment, you know, to journalism and to free media. And I wanted to honor you by introducing you to our audience here on Progressive Radio Network. Marie-Roger Biloa, thank you so much for joining us today. Next time you'll have to do it in person.
Yes, I will, definitely.
Even though we like the sounds of the street in the background, it's still a little dicey, if you will.
Yes.
Thank you so much, and tell your friend who you were going to bring with you, I'm sorry that we didn't get to meet this time, but this is a terrific opportunity, and I'm going to send you the actual podcast of this show, and you'll be able to hear more of it. So thanks for joining us. We're going to go now to another song.
Thank you, Dennis.
Another song from Mizwaki Mbuli from South Africa. That's the anthem, In Debt We Trust, from my movie, In Debt We Trust, 2006. Warning of the debt crisis, warning of the coming financial crisis, which, of course, has now exploded both in the United States initially and now in Europe, where there have been massive protests against austerity in Spain and in Greece, particularly. It's front page in the New York Times. It's front page all over the world. Our guest today is a scholar who has studied all of this, who's from Greece, who can talk to us more about it. If you want to join us and ask him any questions, 888-874-4888. Kat, would you introduce our guest?
I'm sure his name is Kostas Panayiotis. Kaki from Greece, but he's in New York City, associate professor of sociology at New York City College of Technology at the City University of New York, and he's the author of Remaking Scarcity, From Capitalist Inefficiency to Economic Democracy.
Costas, thank you so much for coming on at the last minute to join us here to talk about all of this, because obviously it's one of the leading stories of the world, but I'm not sure that American readers really understand what's happening here. People who are relying on American media understand this crisis in Greece. Can you help us, give us a little, kind of snapshot view of what's happening now, and then we'll have some questions for you and maybe some listeners calling in at 888-874-4888.
Yeah, the current crisis has had many twists and turns so far, and it's expressing itself in various ways in different parts of the world. And in Greece and in Europe, it has taken the form of a debt crisis. And Greece was one of the first countries to face the debt crisis, having a large debt that it had trouble servicing. But now this crisis is extending throughout Europe, especially Southern Europe. And the response to the crisis has been budget cutbacks, brutal austerity measures that reduce people's living conditions, wages, salaries, pensions, taking away labor rights, destroying social services. And many countries like Greece have to adopt these measures in exchange for loans that would allow them to keep servicing the debts. People, as the result, of course, is that the economy is shrinking because people have, as their incomes go down, they spend less, small businesses become affected and they close down. And Greece is an especially acute case of this, and Greeks have been at the forefront of resistance against these policies.
Right. So if you're interested, if you have been interested in Occupy Wall Street, if you are interested in the fight for against inequality in our country, it's important to understand what's happening in Greece. A lot of this loan money that went into Greece, that flooded Greece, was done by American hedge funds and American financial institutions who then immediately wanted their money out and wanted it back. And the price of all of this has been, vicious austerity. The New York Times is reporting in Athens, trade unions called a nationwide strike Wednesday to contest billions of dollars in new salary and pension cuts being discussed by the government and its international creditors. It was the first such walkout since a conservative coalition came to power. In other words, this is a crisis that seems to be cutting across class lines, cutting across political lines. People are furious with what's going on, and there's a massive, uproar in the streets, not only in Greece, but in Spain. Tell us a little bit about the movement in Greece that has been organized in response to these, cutbacks and austerity programs, which don't benefit the people very much.
Yeah, the movement includes people from all walks of life because the vast majority of Greek society is very negatively affected by this. So, of course, labor unions are part of the movement, although some of the, union leaderships at the national level have been criticized by many as not, being proactive enough in the resistance, and some of them are affiliated with the governing parties, which affect their stand. But you also have grassroots movements of solidarity, people organizing in their neighborhoods to help each other cope with the effects of the crisis. And, so it's a very diverse movement. And as more and more Greeks are finding out that these policies are not leading anywhere, they're not resolving the crisis, but they keep making this crisis deeper and deeper. people are basically saying enough is enough.
So it's being imposed, you know, on the people of Greece in many ways. It is, again, the New York Times, you know, saying, for many Greeks who took to the streets, the pact with the government amounts to a bargain with the devil. They quote a secondary school teacher who was wearing a surgical mask she'd been wearing to ward off the tear gas to denounce Greece's foreign creditors. Quote, they just want to impoverish us to bring our salaries down to the level in India and swoop in and buy everything on the cheap, she said, referring to the planned privatization of state assets. She had traveled 40 miles to Athens with several colleagues to attend the protest on Wednesday. Her salary has been cut by a third since the crisis hit. I should have left the country a long time ago. Now I'm stuck here, she said, but I am fighting back. And this is the seems to be the spirit of the Greek people now, are really, you know, not taking this lying down. They are challenging this. And, of course, there is an opposition party, Syriza, which opposed Greece's bailout terms. And they said that the only hope for Greece is rejecting austerity. But if they reject austerity, that means they'll be rejecting the bailout money, too, right?
Well, what Syriza is arguing is that they would they want to renegotiate the loan deal, but they want to get rid of some of the onerous conditions that were imposed as that were attached to this deal. The conditions that basically have destroyed labor rights and have restructured Greek society in a very sort of reactionary direction. And their argument is that, you know, these policies have led to a downward spiral. These policies cannot solve the problems, and that a different strategy is necessary. And that basically Greece is not completely powerless when confronting its creditors. It does have bargaining power because if they force Greece to disorderly default, the whole Eurozone might dissolve. So their argument is that the only hope for Greeks is to basically you know, say no to this to the continuation of these policies.
I mean, this is a major movement going on here. I mean, you know, with strikes and the like. I mean, numerous government services across the country were shut down for days. Main transportation arteries in central Athens were disrupted. Flights to and from the main Athens airports were delayed as air traffic controllers briefly took part in the strike. I mean, this is not going to end anytime soon, is it?
No, this is there was a lull over the summer after the elections in June, but now the new wave of measures is going to be introduced in the parliament in coming weeks. So resistance is likely to peak once again, and we are going to have more protests in the future. And it's all a reflection of the magnitude of assault on people's living conditions. It's an economic catastrophe, humanitarian catastrophe. The Greek economy has shrunk by 20% in the last 3 years. This is a kind of shrinkage that is only comparable to the Great Depression of the 1930s. And unemployment is at going up to 25% with, you know, unemployment for young workers being over 50%.
You're comparing this.
Let
me just reinforce this point because Catherine wants to ask a question here. But you're comparing this to the Great Depression of the 1930s, maybe even more severe now in Greece. Catherine, what was your question?
I mean, it's just what I hear Costos saying is that the people really need to just, you know, to take the controls and completely take the controls away from, you know, the people that you know, have most of the leverage now. I mean, like, that's the only way it's going to work. And as long as, you know, the powers that be keep wanting to, like, have the leverage and wanting to, like, renegotiate, and, you know, thinking that the people are going to go for it, of course the people are going to just continue to lose. So the only, you know, it just, you know, it's pretty obvious, like, the only solution is for the people to just completely, you know, like, pull the rug out underneath, you know, the powers that be. I mean, you know, if they can. I mean, that's the idea.
If they can. What about Spain, Costas? What? How do you see that in the equation here? What's happening in Spain is also a big uprising, if you will.
Yeah, Spain is an important case. It's a much larger economy than Greece. And if Spain were to go, I mean, the Eurozone would be in deep trouble. And, you know, what is look, it's looking now like, you know, Spain will also have to turn to the European Union for a bailout. And Spain has, of course, you know, been adopting these austerity programs even before, you know, turning to the Europeans for a bailout. And the results have also been very, very negative for its population. Spain also has a very high unemployment rate of, you know, 25%, very high unemployment rate for young people. You know, they had a real estate bubble, so lots of people are being foreclosed on. You read stories about, you know, one of the towns in Spain had actually forced supermarkets to lock the garbage bins so as to prevent, you know, citizens from looking for food in garbage. So the situation in Spain is also very critical, and that's why you see, you know, a growing movement of resistance. And the Spanish government, of course, is trying to deal with that through repression, including the use of rubber bullets. Greece is not a unique case. It reflects a more general problem, a more general crisis that is European and indeed global in scope.
You know, but also, I mean, this is the intensity of this is new. And on Tuesday in Spain, tens of thousands of demonstrators besieged the parliament to protest the austerity measures planned by, you know, the conservative leader who won because, you know, I think the socialists did such a lousy job of communicating their issues or taking a strong stand. Last week, more than 500,000 people marched in cities across Portugal to protest an increase in social security contributions. 1 million people marched in Barcelona calling for, among other things, Catalan independence, trying to pressure the Spanish government. I mean, this is moving at a rate, you know, that's really intense, isn't it, Costas?
Yeah, and one of the things that is important about Portugal, of course, is that actually the Portuguese government was forced to back down on part of its austerity program. And it's important to have moments like that where it's not like just people protesting, but but you have actual victories. So this is very heartening, especially coming from Portugal, because oftentimes, you know, the mainstream media portray Portugal as being the good student of, you know, the IMF and the European Union, taking the austerity medicine with stoicism, as opposed to being difficult and obstreperous like the Greeks. So it's interesting to see that, you know, as the same policies, austerity policies, are applied across the European South, and as these policies, you know, fail universally, you have also a universal movement of resistance that is growing, and it's growing because people are becoming increasingly aware of the fact that these policies are very harmful to them and to the vast majority of the society.
We live in a globalized world and a globalized economy. What happens in one place often impacts on other places. Americans, you know, look at this, they say, well, it's Greece. Greece, well, you know, they were living so large in Greece. They had such great benefits, and now they're paying the piper because they lived over their means. You know, in Spain, you know, they're saying something similar. But how is this going to play out, do you think, in terms of the American economy, which is struggling, as you know, to try to recover, yet the American economy is tied to the economies of the rest of the world, too.
Yeah, this is a global crisis, and of course the European crisis, we should remember it, you know, it's sort of just a reverberation of a crisis that started in the United States. So as you were mentioning before, it's kind of what you had was that many of the financial institutions in the U.S. and Europe who, you know, took lots of irresponsible risks and had to, and were on the, you know, verge of failure, were then bailed out by national governments. So some of the European governments that are now in trouble in terms of debt, they don't have the debt because they were irresponsible before the crisis. Some of them had low deficits, like Spain or Ireland, and now they're heavily indebted because they bailed out private banks. So what you have is a global crisis, and we shouldn't, you know, accept this kind of portrayal of the Europeans supposedly living large and now they're paying the price. This is the same pattern we've seen in the United States of, you know, having a crisis that is caused by, you know, the financial sector and capitalist elites, and now the cost is being paid by ordinary citizens and workers. The same is happening in Europe. And of course, it's true. All the global economy is very closely connected. So the U.S. is very much affected by the crisis in Europe. It's also affected by the fact that growth is slowing down in China. And so this crisis is still playing itself out. It's a global crisis. There will be more episodes to the crisis. Sometimes the sort of center of our attention shifts from one part of the world to another. But we are in for, you know, protracted stagnation and protracted class struggles and social conflicts in the coming years, both in Europe and the U.S. and around the world.
Isn't the Federal Reserve Bank in the United States like also involved in the European Union? Like I recently heard the radio host Ben Swan, I think it was QE3, he pretty much, like the first QE3, like made the U.S. banks filled their pockets, and the second QE3 filled the pockets of the European banks.
Well, I think there has been, you know, monetary policy has been one of the ways that, you know, authorities in the U.S. and Europe have tried to manage this this crisis. One of the differences between Europe and the U.S. is that the European Central Bank has traditionally had a much harder line when it came to intervening in ways that amounted to printing money. It's much more opposed to that. And that's one of the reasons, of course, that the crisis in Europe has deepened because, you know, the European Central Bank has not been willing to step up to the plate. The U.S. Fed, on the other hand, did much more. It sort of responded to the crisis in a much more aggressive way. And that's why, you know, bad as things are in the United States in terms of unemployment, they're not quite as bad as they are in Europe. And even in Europe now, the European Central Bank has had to sort of relax its stance a little bit and basically promise that it's willing to buy bonds of countries in trouble, like Italy and Spain.
They're going to spread more money around, it looks like. Listen, Costas, thank you so much for coming in and on the phone with us and helping us to understand all this. I mean, it's obviously going to affect us. It's already affecting millions of people who are suffering. You know, we read about people who are proud workers who are foraging for food in the garbage cans of Spain and Greece. People who are, you know, not getting medical attention, not getting all sorts of things and benefits that they had relied on for a long time because of this crisis. It's something we must know about. It's something we must be concerned about. Thank you so much for participating with us. I'd love to have you back on and to help us be updated about this. So we're going to move on now. But again, thank you very much for joining us. Your book again, Acosta, just so people know what it is.
remaking scarcity from capitalist inefficiency to economic democracy, plutocracy. It was my pleasure to be in your show.
Okay, thank you so much. Now, Catherine, you've been very active on this whole question of the Fed. There was a big demonstration here in New York, all around the country, about the Federal Reserve. Why should we? I think we're going to cut out of this call. Thank you. Why are we concerned about the Federal Reserve Bank in your mind?
We're actually. I mean, one of the biggest things I think that we're just trying to make people aware, you know, because of course the term, you know, Federal Reserve Bank can throw people.
In other words, they think it is a federal bank. That's right. It's a government bank, but it isn't, right?
Right. It is a privately owned bank. And we had a whole stack of these wonderful Bernanke books with the picture of Ben Bernanke on the front. You know, it looks like a big dollar bill. And on the back, you know, just, you know, some basic facts about the Fed that most people are not aware, which is right, that the Federal Reserve is a private banking cartel, not a government agency, as the name applies. And that, you know, representatives from J.P. Morgan companies, the Rockefeller banking conglomerate, Kuhn, K-U-H-N, Loeb and Company, gathered on Jekyll Island back in 1910 off the coast of Georgia, which most people are not really aware, you know, only from G. Edward Griffin's book, The Creature from Jekyll Island, which is I'm not even sure like when that came out. And, you know, they did it in secret. They had a secret meeting. Again, it was on Christmas holiday when most people were, you know, with their families, and they drafted what would be known as the Federal Reserve Act. Congress then passed this act, giving it this private organization quasi-governmental powers, which are in direct violation to the U.S. Constitution.
So how did it go in terms of the demonstration?
Well, unfortunately, in New York City, we didn't have, you know, the greatest turnout. They did have it in a bunch of other cities, Atlanta, Philly, cities in like Minnesota and in various places that I believe had a better turnout than we did. But, you know, the people in New York, like, we're kind of like diehards. We did start over at the Fed. You know, my friend Tatiana Moroz played a few songs, a few of her Liberty songs. And, you know, Dan Panzella, again, like kind of spoke and gave some factual information. And then we kind of walked down to like where the stock exchange was down there by 23 Wall Street by the steps with our signs and our Bernanke bucks and handed them out. And I think having some music, you know, attracted people. So some tourists, Asian tourists, were kind of, you know, posing and taking pictures with us and things like that. And
at any rate, this struggle is not going to be ending anytime soon. It will continue. Your work and the work of the activists who have been talking about the Fed, it's not just libertarians. It's also, there have also been Republicans and Democrats who are very concerned about this institution, its lack of democratic accountability, its power in a way to print money and to dominate our economy without any checks and balances, run by a committee of bankers, basically, something that we really need to know about. And thank you, Catherine, for telling us about it. We're going to be ending and going out now. We have a very quick comment, please. We're running out of time.
If I could just quickly, there's a paragraph in this Economics for the 99% that they were giving out at the anniversary, the one-year anniversary at Occupy Wall Street. I thought this was a really good paragraph. It's titled Possibilities, and it says the 99% have a huge opportunity to demand changes directed instead at solving their problems and meeting their needs. While neoliberal capitalism was working well on its own terms, it was difficult for the 99% to have much impact. If we don't act now, we're done.
Okay, on that point, Mizwaki Mbuli's final song, thank you for being with us. You can reach me at dissector@mediachannel.org, my blog, newsdissector.net, mediachannel1.org is another website that I'm associated with. Please stay in touch, give us feedback, and give us your help. Thank you very much. Danny Schechter saying goodbye.
in defense of the fatherland. Through cannons of criticism, his dragon force and enthusiasm shall perform a daring combat against fascism. Men shall initiate a campaign against genocidal crimes committed and perpetrated against beloved humanity. Today, housing is another means of exploitation. And before the spirit of Hitler destroys men, wake me up to join you in the march to a people's kingdom. Man is swallowed by limited pleasures of time. Man is forsaken like a memory lost. Say it aloud. Justice is absent and democracy is nil. Say it aloud to counter the state lie. Again, shout it aloud. The government is riding fast to the greatest fall, from one great defeat to another. Two alternative bodies of young and old shall come.